Hello again, everybody. It's Tom making the second part of this little series, two-part series, about the strange business of being a conductor that Michael asked if I'd do for your delight and amusement whilst we're all unable to rehearse. I hope you'll notice that something has improved this week, which is the quality of the audio, because I bought some new kit. And it should sound like I'm now recording from a studio, but I'm not. I'm still in my kitchen. I guess like the rest of us haven't moved far in the last 7 days or so. It was nice to see some people at the Zoom social last Thursday. I'm hoping to join again and be able to stay a bit longer this time. And if you haven't done that yet, it is really nice just to say hello to familiar and friendly faces. And thanks to everyone who helped set all of that up. So the first question I'm going to answer this week is about how do I choose the music that I perform? And I think that will vary from orchestra to orchestra. On the whole, the way I try to do it and the way I'm going to try to do it with FSO as well is to take on board the suggestions of the players. That's really important, because I think if everyone in the orchestra is enjoying the process of working on the music, apart from anything else, you'll tend to work harder to sell tickets to friends and family, because if you're enjoying it and you think it sounds good, then you'd want people to come and listen. And that's what we all want, is as many people as possible to come and enjoy the final performance. But I think it's absolutely crucial, and I speak having made mistakes over the years with this, that I'm really, really passionate about that music. It's absolutely pointless if I were to try and enthuse every week about a piece of music that I'm not enthused about. I don't think I'm very convincing when I try and do that. And that has to be a kind of first base. So not saying that this wouldn't change in the future, but right now, I'll give you a great example. Apologies for everyone I'm about to upset, but if you asked me to conduct Elgar's First Symphony, I would say actually no thanks, because it's never done the thing for me that I know it does for an awful lot of other people. However, if you asked me to conduct Elgar's Second Symphony, I would be more than delighted, because that really is music that speaks to me. Why the first doesn't, why the second does, I could go on, I won't. But that's just an example of where I think I have to be committed to a piece of music to then want to really enthuse to others and try and, transmit that enthusiasm to an audience in a concert as well. There are some more, frankly, boring and pragmatic factors about choice of programme. There are so many things, durations, keys. So I once went to a prom, it had been done deliberately actually, where everything was in C major, and it was a novel idea. It was kind of one of the reasons why I went to it, but by the end of it, man, it was dull to listen to stuff in the same key center. And I don't think you have to be key sensitive or a trained musician at all to notice that sort of thing. Difficulty, clearly you can't have a whole concert full of stuff that's ridiculously hard. Doesn't matter whether you're working with professionals or non. You've got to bear in mind rehearsal time. So that comes into it. Equally, if you have a whole concert where an ensemble feels like it's not really being pushed, I think that most of us are comfortable with just being outside our comfort zone. That's not oxymoronic, but you know what I mean. If you're way outside your comfort zone, it's not fun or enjoyable or educative. But if it's just outside what you're comfortable with, I think that's usually a very good thing. I know it's good for me. And then there are things like instrumentation. So in a program, you try to have pretty much exactly the same sized orchestra for each piece. It makes the rehearsals flow. However, you can, of course, we will, I'm sure, put in the odd strings only or wind brass only piece. That can be a nice variation in sound quality for the audience. But on the whole, you try not to have sort of one extra trumpet who plays 17 notes in one piece. That isn't much fun for whoever that individual is to actually do, let's face it. And then there's the whole business of trying to make it into a program that fits together. And I really like, myself, the kind of connections between pieces in a program. So it could be a completely extra musical connection, like they're all about trees, or there could be an actual musical connection. So it could be composers who were great friends, or something I've always wanted to do and I've never done it yet, but I will, but composers who were notorious drunks. You could have such fun putting a concert together about that. There's quite a few of them, as you may well know. But I think if I can see a poster, if I can see a concert poster when I look at a program, that's usually a mark that it's successful and it's something that you've done to connect the pieces that's going to speak to an audience who, you know, I think it's a great mistake just to chuck pieces of music together that have no connections whatsoever, just pieces that you like to listen to. It doesn't usually communicate beyond the ensemble when you do that, in my experience. So on to the next question about who are my musical heroes. Well, I'll limit these to performers rather than composers, because, you know, composers have to be the ultimate heroes, because we wouldn't have anything to play if they hadn't written it. But for the purposes of this, I'll try and think of my performing musical heroes, some of whom, of course, are going to be conductors as well. That's inevitable. And I find this really difficult because I want personally to have, if at all possible, seen an individual in the flesh performing rather than just someone from a recording or film. However, I will start with Bernstein. I think he's probably a hero to all of us. And the two pieces of music that make him a hero for me, and if he'd written nothing else, he'd still be a hero, are West Side Story, and also his amazing prelude, fugue and riffs. I'm going to try to insert a tiny bit of audio recording of that second piece, because I reckon a lot of people won't know it. So it's written for basically a jazz ensemble, and it was one of those pieces that the clarinetist, amazing musician Benny Goodman, had commissioned. Promise you, it's well worth, I think it's about 11 minutes in total, the whole piece, and it's well worth 11 minutes of your lives to get to know this. I'll just give you a little taster of the prelude. And where that music goes when it gets to the riffs, which I think I can only describe as riotous, it's just amazing. And also from West Side Story, for me, I think, I mean, all of it, but particularly Cool, which is another fugue. I mean, just combining the amazing skill of writing a fugue in the first place, but also making it the funkiest fugue that I can think of. So even though he wrote other amazing things and was himself, of course, a legend as an interpreter, pianist and conductor, that's my first musical hero, is Lenny Bernstein. And then if I just swing it right to the present day, this is an interesting one because it's a conductor and it's not someone whose actual interpretations I entirely agree with. In fact, I quite often, I don't like the way he actually does the music. So why would he be a musical hero of mine? Well, I think it's all about the ideas that he brings in terms of the way that music is presented and also how it's rehearsed and communicated by his orchestra. And his name is Ivan Fischer, and he founded something called the Budapest Festival Orchestra. I was aware that there was this ensemble, but I didn't really understand what it was until I happened to go to one of their concerts at the Royal Festival Hall. Must have been about 3 years ago now. And I went because the programme was actually one of the straightest, but I love straight programmes. I'm quite boring, really. So it was Magic Flute Overture by Mozart, of course, and then the famous Mozart A Major Piano Concerto, which is one of the numbered in the 20s, but I can't remember which one it is now, and Brahms First Symphony. So couldn't be more Overture Concerto Symphony classic than that. But things were clearly not, as it were, normal from the moment the orchestra started to appear on the stage, because I was sat up in the choir seats in the festival. I really like sitting there, and they're also quite inexpensive, top tip. But as the players came on, I noticed that all of them were catching the eye of someone in the audience and sort of greeting them and giving them a smile. And I thought, oh, that's nice. And that's kind of where it started. But what was extraordinary, well, so many things, but was this sense that the orchestra was intensely listening to one another, like sort of two people having a conversation, haven't seen each other for years, and they don't interrupt one another, but they're really extraordinary sense of listening, especially in the piano concerto. The orchestra was also not in the usual formation. So, for example, for that Mozart concerto, the woodwind team, wind and horns, were all sat round the piano in a kind of half moon with the strings behind them. And it just worked for the balance, for first thing, because often in classical music, we can lose the winds and brass. It's not the fault of the strings, but it's difficult when you've got metal strings, when the composers of the day knew the gut strings. But then it was other formations with for the Brahms, the way, I can't remember exactly everything now, but just each piece had a different formation based on what was best for that piece of music. Another thing that they did, which I thought was bizarre at first, but then it made more and more sense to me, when they came on for the beginning of the concert, the oboist didn't sound the note A. That was because they were about to play a piece that was in E flat major, which is as far away from an A as you can get. It's a tritone. So the oboist actually sounded the note G, and then everyone worked on their instruments around the chord of the key of E flat major. So G strings were tuned in the brass, the note B flat, concert pitch was played. And what that meant was that the intonation of that opening of the overture especially was flawless, and it so often isn't. I've heard it with great orchestras where the first few chords are quite sour, and that's because you've just played the note A and then you go and play flat major, which makes no sense. And then right at the end of the concert, although I'd felt some of the speeds in Brahms one were not what I would have done, but the playing was off the register of amazing, I thought, oh, actually, please don't do an encore, because it'll be really obvious. It'll be one of the Brahms Hungarian dances, and they're great, but we've just had a thrilling end to a symphony. I don't need any more music. And I noticed that the conductor, Maestro Fischer, had not left the podium, but the players had already stood up and were moving. So I thought, well, that's really nice. He hasn't gone off on his own, like pretentious conductors we always do. He's just walking off with his troops. That's really good. So I started to leave the festival hall. But then I stopped because it had all gone quiet again, and I realised that the reason that everyone had got up is that the orchestra had reformed itself, walking towards the front of the stage, and was now in the shape of a choir. And then they sang a four-part Brahms song from memory, and it wasn't very long. I don't know what it is, actually. I don't think I ever found out, but it was just the most extraordinarily generous act of musicianship I think I've ever noticed, because the people in this group are not singers in the sense of, you know, trained operatic voices or whatever you want to think of, they're just people like you and me, who can use their voice to sing when we want to. Often we don't want to, but there they were just singing like we'd all gone to the pub for a beer after the concert, and they decided to have a sing along. And I just came away from that concert thinking, actually, this is what it should be like. And if it was like this all the time, I feel sure that some of these perceived, and they are perceived, barriers between orchestras and audiences might be blown away. So I'll give you, I'm just going to give one more musical hero choice. Apologies that these are all male. I've just realised that. It's not deliberate. They're just the ones that immediately sprang to mind. So the third would be my mentor of some years ago, Sir Charles Mackerras, whom I was extremely fortunate to have spent a period of about 18 months working with, is one way of putting it, between 2006 and 2008. So Sir Charles established a conducting fellowship at Trinity Laban Conservatoire down in Greenwich, which is how I got to meet him. I think I mentioned this in the previous podcast, so I won't bore you with that again. But the things that he did as a musician, I think, are possibly not to be repeated, actually, in the sense that he went across so many genres and was a pioneer in all of them, but they're really diverse. So he was a pioneer in the use of research into historic performance practice. So basically looking into things like, for example, how in the classical period composers absolutely expected you to extemporize on their notes to a certain extent. Mozart, you know, in a slow tune, especially on the da capo bit, you would be expected to improvise, and that's something that had totally slipped out of the performance tradition. But he was pretty much single-handedly responsible for bringing it back. Composers earlier than that, he was pioneering performing the music of Handel. But then he went so much later in the repertoire, especially the music of Janáček. So when he went to study conducting in what's now the Czech Republic, shortly after the end of the Second World War, he was told about this operatic composer that no one had heard of outside of that sort of Central Europe, called Janáček. And he went to hear, I don't know which opera it was he heard first, but he was absolutely blown away by what he experienced. He then pretty much single-handedly actually introduced this music to the rest of the world. And now all the Janáček operas are, you know, standard fare in all the great houses around the globe. So pieces like Cunning Little Vixen, House of the Dead, Macropolis Case, perhaps especially Yennefer. And he not only kind of promoted this music, but he did all the hard work on it. Janáček's handwriting and methodology was somewhat unclear, and most of the scores were in a real mess to try and work out what the rhythms were, what the pitches were, even sometimes what the texts were. And so that he could get the latter right, he taught himself to speak Czech, and apparently to the extent that he would correct a native Czech speaker during rehearsals in their pronunciation or grammar, and would be right. And I think that every single performance of his I've ever heard, either live or on record, just has this exciting element that I find missing with so many others. So if you find online, pretty much everything he ever did, but I mean, his interpretations of Dvořák actually always got this extra zing about them. Brahms symphonies, Mozart symphonies, he recorded quite a lot of them later in his life, and everything he did had this zip about it, I think is how I would put it. He was also extremely funny and quite irreverent, and I won't repeat too many of the tales here because it would involve some foul language. But the one that I love is one I read in a book about him a couple of years ago when he was on a break in rehearsals at San Francisco Opera, and he took his assistant conductor with him for the day. And being Charles, he never switched music off, actually. So on his day off, they went down to Tower Records and went to the classical department and spent the afternoon browsing the latest releases. I think this is in the 80s, so this is when the days when you would excitedly go to a record shop to see what had just come out. And apparently, over the tannoy, they were playing something, and Sir Charles was kept being distracted and sort of looking up to see, or listening to, you know, looking up towards the speakers and seeming to get quite upset about something. It was Mozart symphonies, I think. And eventually started sort of muttering away and not really under his breath about it's bloody awful. And God, the intonation's dreadful and the balance is rubbish and the tempos are, oh, this is, Christ, this is awful. And people were starting to sort of look around to see what was going on. And then he finally exclaimed an expletive, I shan't repeat it. And they said, no, it's no good. I'm going to have to record them again. He was a perfectionist. And one of the fact, the last time I saw him alive was not long before he died. And he was taking a rehearsal with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment to prepare a performance of Mozart's Così fan tutte for Glyndebourne. And the first thing he said as he handed out his own set of parts to the players, he always had his own sets of parts for all the major works, he said, look, these are my bowings, everyone, he said, but I've not done it for a couple of years, and if you think they're crap, just change them. And I remember the reaction of the players looking at this kind of absolute living legend, and they weren't minded to change his bowings, as it happens. So yeah, three, I could go on with more, but three of my musical heroes.